It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today I'm in the home of Lillian Darr in Fairfield, Iowa. She is a colorful Iowa character, and she has written about her life and her stories in her memoir. It's called Memoirs of a 90-Year-Old Hippie, Romance, Celebrities, Travel, Comedy, and Tragedy. Lillian, thank you so much for inviting us to visit you today.
Charity, this is a great way to start the new year.
Well, let's go way back in time.
Okay.
You were born in 1921.
You got it.
In New York City.
Actually, Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
If you're
right.
Technical.
We can be technical. That sounds like a good plan. And you were born not out of a marriage that was conceived in happiness, but a marriage that was conceived in sadness. Can
yes.
you tell me the story?
Well, my father came over from Germany when he was 19, and he met this woman who fell madly in love with him. Her name was Lillian Sachs, and they got married, and they had a child, a boy, and a few days later, she passed on. She had some sort of a problem that today would have been considered very, very easy to cure, and so my mother and the baby, my mother felt sorry for the baby and for the widower, and they went back to live at her parents' house. And my father had confessed to me later that he'd always been in love with my mother. My mother was a very beautiful, dynamic, talented, lovely, lovely woman. And he proposed to her, and she married him, I think, more out of a desire to give him a wife and to give the baby a mother. So it was not a real passionate love match.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, you were named for your aunt,
yes.
your father's first wife,
yes.
and your half-brother's mother,
yes.
Lillian.
Yes.
Did you feel like your parents were happy together when you were growing up?
No. As a matter of fact, once my father was a very wonderful man, very honorable, very, very a lovely person. But he was not dynamic. He was, you know, he was just kind of a, I don't know how to describe it anyway. And my mother and father had friends. They were all rather wealthy. And their husbands used to take them out to places, you know, and to theater and to different places. And my mother was deprived of that. She never had that kind of relationship. And I once went to my mother and asked her why she didn't leave my father. I was about 13. It was
wow.
hard.
Yeah.
But they stayed together, and my mother, well, one of my stories in the book is about why our family, my dead mother's secret, or why our family is not $250,000 richer.
Right, which is quite a whopper of a secret.
Yes.
Tell us the secret.
Well, she was very frustrated, I think, sexually, and she, as an outlet, kind of sublimate, she played the futures market. And she did love.
Although she disapproved of gambling.
Yes, she absolutely did not approve
of gambling. She was a gambler herself.
You're right. So what happened was she gambled in the futures market, which was very, very tricky and very, very...
with money borrowed against your father's stock holdings.
He had her, for some reason, well, I know why she wanted it. He signed over stock powers to her, so she would have sway over his holdings. And in those days, they bought gilt-edged stocks, you know, like General Electric, all the big companies. So they had a lot of money. And after she passed on, we met with a lawyer to read her will. And that was when my father first realized that she had really betrayed him. And she'd used all his money to gamble.
Wow.
He still had a bunch left, thank goodness.
That's good. That's good. When you were growing up, as you mentioned, your family was fairly well off. And you went to a private school where you were being raised to be a very proper young lady.
Oh, yes.
The Parker School?
A good little Packer lady.
Packer. There we go.
Yeah, it's a very fine school in Brooklyn. And my mother wanted my brother and me to have the best of everything. And it's a very, very good school. It had an English headmaster, you know, and it was a classic education.
And you learned how to be proper.
Well, too bad I forgot about all that. I'm certainly not very proper now.
Well, I was curious.
In fact, I'm watching my language right now.
And I appreciate that. Did you feel rebellious about that as a child? I mean, clearly you, as life went on, you chose not to lead a conventional life. But when you were growing up and you were going to this private school and you were being taught how to carry yourself and how to stand and how to speak to strangers or not speak to strangers and all of those good manners, did you feel rebellious at that point?
No, I was a naughty girl in school, you know, and several times my mother had to be called down to the principal's office, so they sent me home. I can't remember what I did to earn that, but I was a little bit of a rebel, but had nothing to do with that.
A lot of people say that the idea of teenagers was something that we invented in the 1960s or the 1950s. In your teenage years, was there conflict? Did that create conflict in your family? Were you one of the early, quote, teenagers?
No. Our family was pretty united. I don't remember. I used to have a lot of fights with my mother because that is kind of a mother-daughter thing to do, which you may find out. I hope not.
I hope not, too.
And no, I don't think so. But the school to which I went, I was born into a German-Jewish family, which is like secular. I mean, you know, not really, well, Jewish, but not Jewish. And the school to which I went was a Christian school, actually. We said the Lord's Prayer every morning. We sang hymns and all that sort of thing. So that's really, and in the Christmas pageant, I was an angel hovering over the baby Jesus in the manger. So it was all that. And, you know, that was fun. I mean, I feel very privileged to have had that education.
And your mother really wanted you to work before you got married?
Well, she didn't particularly want me to, but she was very avant-garde. And in those days, girls of that class would just prepare for marriage and motherhood and all this sort of thing. But my mother suggested I go to secretarial school and learn how to be a secretary, which I did, and which enabled me actually to work for these famous authors.
Right. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean, your career as a secretary was brief, but it was
it
illustrious.
It was very, very, very brief. And there were reasons for that. It was not my doing. the first job I got, a cousin of mine said that, I think it was Ben Hecht was looking for Ben Hecht was a very, very famous author then, and a playwright. And a cousin of mine said that he heard from somebody who knew Ben Hecht that he was looking for a secretary. So I went and interviewed, and I can remember the outfit I was wearing, a raspberry dress and a brown felt hat, and I had been having a fight with my mother, and I was crying, so my eyes were all red. But we had a nice interview. He had a very lovely wife by the name of Rosie Hecht. And I think, do you remember the song Rosie the Riveter? Mm-hmm. During the war, a lot of the women went to work in factories. I think that song was named for her.
Really?
And I had a check that was made out to me. And a friend of mine, because he printed things for the government, made this big, big, big blow up of the check. I thought it was Ben Hecht's signature, very valuable. Turned out to be Rosie's.
So she was signing the check.
Yeah, really. Yeah, and then Norman Cousins. So many people do know about Norman. He was such a wonderful man. He founded the Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy. He was into a lot of good, wonderful, beautiful things, and a wonderful man. And again, somebody told him that told me he was looking for a secretary. So I went up, and that was really beautiful, but it only lasted 10 days.
10 days.
Because, actually, it's interesting with Ben Hecht. I apologized for not being a terribly efficient note taker, secretary. He said, that's all right. He said, the most valuable secretary I ever had was one who made up her own way of doing things. But Norman, I had become engaged to her father, Bob Bush, and he was on leave from the Navy. He was an officer in the Navy. And I think that Norman felt that any day I might leave to get married to Bob. So right. It was a little precarious for him. So that's why. I mean, that was a good reason for him.
You were married quite young, and you dated quite a bit before you got married. But
I was 22.
22, right.
Is that considered young?
It is now. It wasn't then. though.
Well, getting married at all is considered strange.
I find it very interesting. You write about your courtship with your first husband, and his mother seemed to be bound and determined that you would marry her son. How did that come about?
She was a fixer. She was amazing woman. Very funny, very great sense of humor, but very controlling. She wooed me, really. The first time I met Bob, he was in the service, and she was meeting him for lunch over at the Officers Club in Brooklyn. And she called me up. She had been told by a friend of hers, whose son I dated, that I was a nice girl, you know. So she called me, and she said, my son is coming back, and I'm having dinner with him. Will you please join us? I said, well, you know, don't you want to be alone with your son? He's been off on a trip. No, I went. So she came down. In those days, we had rationing, gas rationing. But she took the bus down to where I lived in Greenwich Village. She was so anxious to see what I looked like that when she got, it was raining. She opened the door, and she left the door open, you know, just to be able to gawk at me. And I said, Mrs. Sussman, would you please close the door? The rain's coming in. And we went over to the Navy Yard, and Bob hadn't shaven. He was... You know, he was kind of, he hadn't had time to do all that. And we had a lovely time. And as we left Bob, we were walking out to the car, and he said, Mom, she's lovely, which was a lie.
I'm talking with Lillian Darr. She has written about her life in Memoirs of a 90-Year-Old Hippie. You can see pictures from our visit on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Her website is 90yearoldhippie.com. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Last week, I traveled to Fairfield, Iowa to visit with Lillian Darr. She has written about her life in the book Memoirs of a 90-Year-Old Hippie. Her website is 90yearoldhippie.com, and she's actually 93 years old now. We sat down and had a chat in her kitchen. Your first husband, Bob, was in the Navy during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about when you decided to get married.
His parents had bought a house, a beautiful home in Stamford, Connecticut, and they took me along, and we went up there, and they stayed at a hotel, and Bob and I had separate rooms, and they had their own room, and somehow Bob and I merged. I mean, you know, we got in the same room, and we were talking, and we were talking, and we talked all night, and that was, I think, when he asked me to marry him. And I said, you know, I will never marry anyone whom I do not see in civilian clothes.
You thought maybe you were too dazzled by the uniform?
Possibly. I just didn't trust it. So when we went back to their beautiful place in New York, he went to the closet, and he disappeared, and he came out in a Brooks Brothers suit. And I think
he passed the test.
Yes. He was a lovely man, but... Unfortunately, manic depressive.
Right. You got married when he was still serving, so
yes.
You didn't have much time together before you had
days.
To go back. 10 days.
10 days. That's hard.
And then how long were you apart after that 10 days?
About 8 months, and he came home on leave, and then he left again. And it was a very, very difficult time because you're in the first throes of romance, you know, and it's not easy.
Right.
And he wanted, you know, we were hoping that I could go down to Bermuda where he was stationed. To be with him, and I had been to Bermuda, and it's so beautiful. But he was in a position. They were training other destroyers. He was on a destroyer escort. They were training other ships, and it was called Forces Afloat. And so nobody was allowed to be there for security reasons. So that's why we were separated a lot of time. And then he finally came home, August 1945. That was when the war was over.
And you mentioned that he was manic depressive. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder much later in life.
He was institutionalized at one time.
Right.
It was very, very
But
hard.
You saw the signs right away when he came back from serving.
Actually, I didn't. We were staying at my mother's house, and he was, instead of going out to look for a job, he was sleeping a lot. And my mother-in-law had a brother who was a very, very famous doctor, and he diagnosed him as being depressed. So that was the beginning of that, you know. But it was very, very hard. Poor guy. I felt, you know, it was very hard for him.
And for you.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And for my children.
Right.
I mean, we just, they were brought up in a very, very tempestuous home, which was very unfortunate. And I think they all suffered. But I think the one who suffered the most was Robbie, the boy who passed on. And but, you know, somehow we all survived, the three of us, you know, the three children and me. And we're very good friends, thank goodness.
And you had four children.
Yes.
How long were you married before the children started arriving?
Well, she was born in 25. And
Judith, your oldest.
46.
1946,
yes.
Okay.
So it was just a few years. And we had a wonderful post-war vacation, took the car and went up to New England. And then we came back and we settled in Greenwich Village. We had a tiny little apartment. It was really sweet. And when Judith was born, we put her in a closet. It was the only space where we could put her crib. And then eventually we moved to Long Island.
And Bob started working in the advertising industry?
He was in the advertising industry. He worked for a company called VO Tuigo. There's a funny story in there about that, which it could be apocryphal. I'm not sure if it really happened. But the story goes that the advertising company had a product that it wanted to unveil, and it wanted to make a very dramatic unveiling. So they invited all the people from the advertising industry to come and sit there. And there were a lot of people there. And they had this big, big box, a big box with a curtain over it. And they were going to be advertising for a soap, a laundry soap powder. And the time came, and somebody pulled the thing. The box was unveiled, and the name of the product was Dreck, which in, I guess, Yiddish or Hebrew or something means dirt, filth. You know, it was a very, very funny thing.
Somebody didn't test that out very well, did they?
No, they didn't. And there were a lot of Jewish people in the industry. Yeah. So I'm sort of surprised that it happened. It could be where Dreft came from. I'm not sure.
So Bob's career ended up taking you to Los Angeles.
Yes, he was the advertising agency, the same company in Beverly Hills.
And you ran in some pretty dizzying circles because of Bob's work in the advertising industry.
Well, also his work in the theater. I mean, that's, you know, when I met all these, you know, Leonard Bernstein and Olivier and Lee and, you know, all these people, it was because he was involved in all these careers. Yeah. But it was lovely out in Los Angeles. We loved it. We had a good time there, and the weather, of course, was wonderful.
Now, you refer to yourself as a hippie, and we'll get to that in a little while. But when did you become politically active?
There was a time when I moved to Los Angeles, I joined a group called the United Nations Association. I don't know if you remember Marsha Hunt. She was an actress. At that time, she was quite well known. And she was the chairperson of that group. And a friend of mine invited me to join, and I did. And I used to go around. We were trying to get China into the United Nations. At that time, this was very controversial. And we had UNICEF cards that we used to sell. And I used to go around the neighborhood to make money for UNICEF, you know, for the Children's Education Fund of the United Nations. And I used to go around the area selling these cards, and I was branded as a communist. Because I was supporting the United Nations. And in those days, there were all these very ultra-conservative people who thought the United Nations was a communist.
This was in the 1950s?
1950s, yeah.
And being branded a communist in the 1950s was a very dangerous thing, particularly where you were.
I know.
So was that, did that impact your family?
No, it didn't affect me at all.
We've heard a lot of stories about the Hollywood blacklist.
Oh, my God. I knew some of those people. Some of them had to go to England and change their names. But we used to picket. I was always picketing in front of the federal building. And the police, I don't know what the cause was at that time, but the police belonged to a very conservative organization. And they used to call Pinko, Pinko, Pinko when we were demonstrating. Or we would have a sip-in, we called it. There was a company, there was a chain of Vandecamps, of restaurants, and they did not employ any people except white people, and we were protesting. So we'd go, and we would sit there, and we would order a five-cent glass of orange juice and sit there for hours and sip it, try to tie up the table.
Did you and Bob see eye to eye about your political activity?
Oh, definitely.
Activity?
No question. Oh, my husband did.
you mentioned earlier Bob's struggle with depression, with being bipolar disorder. You also write about in the book the fact that he would become violent during some of his
episodes. Well, I probably provoked him.
Well, but...
Yeah, but he, no, there was violence. I can remember once...
And domestic violence was much more accepted at this point
in
time.
It wasn't on the front burner like it is now.
Right.
But I probably provoked him because I was so frustrated. And there were times when, he did hit me once when we were going into the city for some reason, theater or to see friends. My face was... kind of black and blue, but it was very sad because he was such a beautiful human being and he was out of control.
Given that you were in that situation, were you worried about your kids?
No, not at all. Except that they were exposed. Sometimes I'd be lying on the floor screaming the primal scream just out of frustration. So in that sense, I wasn't worried about them physically, but I was very worried about the what was happening to them in the environment.
The two of you separated more than once.
Oh, yes.
Part of the reason for separation is because you fell in love with someone else.
Well, actually... Yes, my third cousin's second husband, John, he was a traveling salesman, and he came to Los Angeles once, and Bob and I met him at the airport. I hadn't seen him. We knew each other as children. He had always had a crush on me, and I was not responsive. But he came to the airport, and we met him, and he was just so lovely. He was so interested and so concerned about us and such an interesting person. And I would meet him when he came into the airport, and Bob, being depressed, was on his bed so much of the time. It was easier for me, actually, when he was doing that than when he was up, because the manic part was very difficult.
It's harder to handle.
Yeah, so I would go to the airport and meet John, and we'd talk, and yes, we did fall in love.
And we'll emphasize third cousin here.
Third cousin, definitely. Too old to have children, anyway.
You and Bob, I mentioned you separated more than once. That was a marriage that you both had a hard time letting go of.
Oh, yeah, we loved each other until he died. Yeah, we always had a great affection for each other. Just couldn't make it. But I was that way with all my former husbands. I mean, when I left John to come out to Fairfield, we still met and traveled together and, were lovers and friends. And until I met Bill Dar in Fairfield.
You moved with Deborah to Berkeley. This was in the 1960s.
Yes.
So Berkeley was a very exciting place to be in the 1960s. Tell me about it. What was it like?
It was a boiler of activity, and anti-war. It was the Vietnam War we were struggling against, and civil rights and civil liberties and women's rights, and everything was just happening in Berkeley. And I had a lovely house there. It was really a wonderful place. And people would come to Berkeley, and the TM Center was there, and the
Transcendental Meditation.
Transcendental Meditation, and the director of the center would send everybody up to my house when they came to town. So I had like wall to wall people sleeping on my floor, which was great. It was a very exciting time, and it did have an effect on the future.
It became a very important part of your identity.
I guess it did. I guess it did. I guess that's when my hippie days started.
What was important to you about that? I mean, you had four kids, three of them were in college, and you had just gone through a divorce, or maybe in the throes of a divorce. What was it about this movement that got you so excited and gave you focus?
And gave me?
Focus. I mean, you...
It was a very, very deep concern to me. And it still is, you know? I mean, I'm not going out picketing or demonstrating now, but I'm doing everything I can for the environment, for the planet, I did for Obama. I worked for Obama, which is another story.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to that.
And Maharishi said that when you meditate, you're affecting the environment because you're not only dissolving more stresses within your own certain nervous system, but you're also helping to dissolve stresses in the environment. So in a way, a lot of us feel that we're helping the environment that way.
When did you first get involved with transcendental meditation?
In 1971, my son was meditating. This was in Berkeley. And he said, Mom, you should really start transcendental meditation. There was a very active center there. I said, you know, I don't have to do that. I'm working for all the good causes, supporting the environment and all this sort of thing. He said, Mom, you don't understand. What I did not understand, that we all accumulate stresses in the nervous system, and that this was a way to dissolve those stresses.
And you've been honored at the Berkeley TM Center, right?
Well, every year they give out awards. What do they call it? The Maharishi Award. And at that time they did. And then when we were in Hawaii, we had the cheesecake business, which is another story. And when we were in Hawaii, we got the award for the best business. So we had two. I used to have them. I don't know where they are now.
What brought you to Fairfield, Iowa?
Originally, I came to be near the children. Judith was here, and Chris and Victor, and Julie and Chris, my son and daughter-in-law, and the grandchildren. So I wanted to be near them.
You met your third husband, Bill, here in Fairfield. Did you imagine that you would fall in love again in your 70s?
That was a surprise. He was beautiful and a painter. I don't know if you've seen any of his artwork. I have it hanging on the walls. But he was a painter and he taught art. Yeah, he was a very, very beautiful man. And it was amazing, really amazing. I would say the love of my life.
You worked for the Obama campaign. And there's a very, very famous photograph of you with President Obama, or before he was president.
Right, Senator.
Right. Tell me about that encounter. He was in Fairfield on his campaign.
He was in Fairfield. It was before the election. And he was speaking in the gazebo here in town, and a lot of people went to hear him. And afterwards, I heard him speak, and I was so moved by him. I went up to him, and I said, does age have its privileges? And I threw my arms around him.
So apparently age does have its privileges.
and he was, they caught a picture of it, and it went all around the world. Somebody saw it in Italy and France and Russia, I don't know, all over.
And it made it in a lot of his campaign ads on television, right?
That's right, that's right. And I just felt that I hoped that it helped with that demographic, the little white-haired lady with white skin.
A lot of people will want to learn from you. Because we all want what you have. We want to be vibrant and happy and healthy in our 90s. What would you say to people if they ask you for advice?
For one thing, I would tell them to read the Desiderata, which is at the end of my book. That has an awful lot of good advice in it. It's a creed, and it's very, very beautiful. And one of the lines there is, be gentle with thyself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. And it has a lot of other, you know, remember that silence is valuable. A lot of stuff in there. It's very beautiful. So if you ask me for my creed, I would say that is. But also, you got to just go with it. Don't resist. I don't know what to say. I don't feel like I have any wisdom to impart.
Lillian, thank you so much for telling your stories today.
Charity, what can I say to sit here at the table opposite you and see your bright, shining face? It's such a treat. Thank you so much for coming to my home.
Lillian Darr. She has written about her life in Memoirs of a 90-Year-Old Hippie. Her website is 90yearoldhippie.com. And you can see pictures from our visit on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with two scholars who are bringing 17th and 18th century recipes into modern kitchens and blogging about it. That's coming up next on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.